talking about the multi-scale simulation of membrane-bound proteins. And this picture has nothing to do with membrane-bound proteins, but it has to do with all these wonderful storms that the Californians have been sending us over in Utah, because that's kind of what it looked like as of about 2 weeks ago. So thank you very much for especially that one yesterday. That was really quite the whopper. I'm going to form this entire talk around these three questions. And this is a simulation snapshot here of the transmembrane part of the influenza A M2 proton channel in a DMPC bilayer. And you can actually see the membrane-bound protein here. You've got the lipids surrounding it in a hydration layer. All of this is under periodic boundaries. And this is quite a common way of simulating using molecular dynamics membrane-bound proteins at this point in time. And I want to ask three questions. Is the atomistic level structure of a membrane-bound protein influenced by phenomena that occurs far away from the protein? And going beyond the idea that is it just the lipid environment surrounding the protein that matters, I'm going to ask an even bigger question. Does it care what's going on, say, 100 or 1,000 nanometers away, perhaps in terms of undulation modes of the membrane or plane stress fields of the membrane that you can't access with a small system size like this? Another question, do membrane-bound proteins interact with slowly varying long-wavelength mesoscopic stress fields? And this kind of goes back to the talk that we had before, that the long-wavelength membranes can both undulate, they can have local compressions if they want. And finally, are membrane-bound proteins affected by mesoscopic level phenomena? So, keeping these ideas in mind, here's a quick answer. This is actually the shortest talk. I've only got two slides, and now it's over. No, I'm just kidding. The quick answer is yes. And I'm going to explain all this throughout the talk in more detail, but I don't want to hold this to the very end. I want to kind of bring it out front right now. And if you can draw your eye to this image here, if we look at the protein, and the lipids in the water are still there, I just got rid of them for the moment, and perhaps focus on what is known as the histidine 37 residues. There's four of them.
What protein is this?
This is the influenza A, or the transmembrane part of the influenza A M2 proton channel.
That's a capsid, part of the capsid protein structure, this virus?
Or? It's not a virus. It's just one of the proteins that go into your membrane. In fact, please don't lecture me on the biology of this thing at this moment. All I know is the transmembrane part. The really important bits are not there.
But it's a channel.
This part is the channel. And in fact, I want to focus on even something smaller, the four histidine 37 residues, which form kind of the narrowest part of the channel, and in fact are the barrier to proton transport. So imagine this scenario, and these two plots here kind of match the color scheme over here. Suppose we have a way of bringing down mesoscopic stress fields, and this is what I will talk about later, to act on this protein. These are these red lines, compression fields. And at this point, I'm only going to talk about compression because the problems we've seen before can get incredibly complicated. As a function of time, and perhaps the open and the closed states, this red line here is the mesoscopic plane strain acting on the system.
What are the gray bars?
I'm going to get to those. I'll walk you through it. This green line here is the response of the atomistic level system. And I want to be very careful. It's not just one atomistic level system. It is an ensemble of atomistic level systems subjected to this mesoscopic plane strain. In the open and closed case, you can see that they're both fairly tightly coupled. The blue line is the interesting one, because this is the plane strain as evaluated through the XY components of the radius of gyration of these histidine 37 residues. And what you can see is that it's actually coupled to the mesoscopic signal. And what that's saying is that as plane stress fields are being pumped down to the system, this small atomistic level structure is, in fact, picking up a mode and going along for the ride. Depending on, now, in this open and closed state, and these shaded bars here, just to show that specific regions where if you actually see, in this case, the system being compressed, you actually see a contraction of the histidine 37 residues, and in this case, you see an expansion, you also see a dilation. So as a very quick answer, one can say that yes, atomistic level structures do mesoscopic stress field.
So the lateral tension varies throughout the membrane, so which is the one?
Pardon me?
The lateral tension varies throughout the membrane, so which is the one you're actually talking about?
The lateral, this is the PXX, PYY component. The Z component here is under zero normal stress. So right now, it's a uniform dilation field.
Okay, it's like the average over the entire...
Yes. That's all we can get in. So, and as I said, I'm going to go into all the bits and pieces. I just want to use this as a teaser to kind of say, rather than an hour from now, say yes, you know. Fair. So, as a brief outline, given that that was the brief teaser, the way that we do this, I'm going to talk about this as a bit as this idea. We call it multi-scale coupling. And it is a computational scheme in which we can take atomistic level systems and bring them in contact with the continuum level surroundings, and in a sense, bridge the two. And then with that, a brief overview of coupling molecular dynamics with continuum models, how we are approaching this problem of mesoscopic membranes and solvents. In the previous talk, that would probably be the ideal way to do it, but you know, my math isn't good enough, so I'm just going to use a simulation to answer all these tough problems. The consequences of coupling molecular dynamics with a continuum. And then finally return to the problem and look at this multi-scale simulation of an influenza A M2 proton channel and how it changes when it's allowed to interact and non-interact with these longer wavelength phenomena. So this is kind of the picture of what we do, multi-scale coupling. We take an ensemble of atomistic level systems. In fact, we use 8. Why do we use 8? Because that's the number of processors I have lying around at the moment. And we effectively embed it into a mesoscopic continuum level representation of a bilayer in an explicit mesoscopic solvent. And this little patch here gives you kind of the relative length scales. And what we can actually do then is create an atomistically detailed window in an otherwise continuum level model. And it gives us some information of, at the atomistic level, what's going on. So it's kind of the inverse picture. We are on the atomistic end looking outwards rather than at the continuum end looking down. So question, how is this done, what does it do, and why do it this way? If you work with molecular dynamics simulation, the first thing you realize is that one of the tricks that's very commonly employed is periodic boundary conditions. So you take a fairly small system size, 10,000, 20,000 atoms. You know, today people are actually doing millions of atoms, but this motif still reoccurs. You use periodic boundary conditions. And the idea is never to take the atomistic level system out of this array and, in a sense, trick it into thinking that it was part of this more continuum level structure. And in this case, this is our mesoscopic membrane. This is our explicit mesoscopic solvent. And the idea here is that, I mean, obviously, there are a multitude of interactions that could be pumped down to this atomistic level system. And right now, we are going to pick kind of the simplest garden variety set. It can be enriched later on when we understand a little more what we're doing. But the rule is never actually pluck the molecular dynamic system out of the periodic array. There's really no reason to officially attempt to embed this thing, because it's more just a hydrodynamic reference frame problem. So this is an interesting idea, but I mean, I think there's a couple of issues that need to be addressed first. Haven't other people done this? You know, like coupling atomistic level systems with continuum level models. It's been approached before. How did we do this? What does it mean fundamentally to let atoms interact with continuum level volume elements that are, say, covered by a constitutive relation? What does that mean? Can you even do it? What is the mesoscopic system? And is the behavior that we observe applicable or realistic to a real membrane-bound protein? So this is kind of my homework slide. The first answer is yes. People have develop schemes to embed atomistic level systems in continuum level models. I'll let your eyes just kind of go through this. But one of the themes that comes out of this, and in fact, and most of these are actually solid state problems, is a general picture that looks something like this. You have some continuum level region, you have some atomistic level region. You enforce that there is some separation of space and time scales. And in the case of membrane-bound proteins and membranes, we don't have a humongous timescale separation to begin with. And one of the things that seems to be needed in all of these approaches is you need some sort of buffer region between your continuum level system and your atomistic level system to handle mass and momentum conservation. But there's a problem, and you can see this problem with a very simple thought experiment. The atomistical, well, how do you handle scenarios when one of your atoms drifts out of your molecular dynamics region and kind of floats into the continuum level ether? You can't push it back or you put an external field on the system. How do you handle electrostatics? They're discrete at this point and perhaps described as some Poisson-Boltzmann treatment out here. The upshot is that your Hamiltonian is somehow going to have to incorporate the creation and annihilation of particles in order to maintain some sort of mass conservation. So it's very tricky. And I like to flip the idea around. Like, what happened if 30 or 40 years ago nobody had the insight to employ periodic boundaries? And ever since then, people have been trying to develop schemes in which to handle this scenario and creating just horrible-looking statistical mechanics to handle it. And imagine someone actually came along and said, hey, I got an idea. Why don't we just say when a particle leaves this side, it just enters over there? Periodic boundaries are great. So in that idea, there's an alternative solution to explicitly trying to embed your atomistic level system in a continuum. Number one, never get rid of your periodic boundaries. Alternatively, use the periodic cell to create some sort of average material property chunk of your atomistic level system. You embed this into your continuum without the need for a buffer because it's now a continuum within a continuum. And then you can use the deformations on the chunk to modulate the periodic cell vectors of your atomistic level system. And this way the equations of motion stay intact here, the electrostatics stay intact here.
There must be simple cases where this would just fail miserably.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. Believe me. let me walk you through. More often than not, probably. And I'll get to that. That's a very good point. I'll get to that. So bigger questions: what are the consequences? The continuum level fields are very smoothed out. The atomistic level responses of those fields are not, especially when you consider a single atomistic level system. Question, should the atomistic level system push back against the continuum field? If the continuum squishes, should an individual system push back? And how should the separation of time scales be handled? So, this is kind of addressing your question, but in bit by bit. Multi-scale coupling, I'll do it in pictures and then I'll do it in some math. This kind of gives you kind of a heuristic flavor. The first step is to coarse grain your entire MD system into a smoothed out elastic chunk of material. Now this is very easy to do in Photoshop, but it's very difficult to do in practice. Especially in the case of a bilayer, for example, because this thing not only has elastic components to its constitutive relations, say in terms of its bulk and bending, but it also has a shear viscosity. So in order to construct this, you have to have some idea at the other end the kinds of problems that you want to do. And I'm going to restrict the problem to the case of a zero surface tension mesoscopic membrane that is simply undulating. On average, there is no shear stresses going on, and I can look at uniform dilations and contractions only. I'm also going to use a very small molecular dynamics system that at this length scale doesn't even have undulation modes except for maybe peristaltic and protrusion modes. So that simplifies this problem in this particular case, but in the general case, yeah, you know, if you want to do an arbitrary anisotropic elastic system, you've got, what, 81 elements in your elasticity tensor to figure out and, you know, get back to you in a year or two. Step two, embed this chunk, not the MD system, into your mesoscopic model. But what I want to do now is I'm pulling up this blue membrane and a white solvent lot, and I want to digress a bit and explain how we are doing our approach to mesoscopic membranes and solvents. And the motivation for the kind of the very discrete nature of the problem is not by accident. This, from the onset, has been designed in terms of a simulation methodology in which we can couple different systems in a multi-scale sense. So, and as the previous talk went on, but the idea of a continuum level membrane is that we can really do it as a field theory representation of some elastic material in a viscous solvent. And there's no atomistic level detail here, perhaps except in a multi-scale sensors, which we're kind of talking about now. And this is just a snapshot of some work that we've done about looking at domain dynamics. We're using a Kahn-Hilliard composition dynamics coupled to membrane undulation dynamics. And it's really just more for a graphical representation at this point. I don't want to go into the results of that. But in terms of a mesoscopic membrane, this is a free energy functional based on, say, the Helfrich Hamiltonian. It might be written in a slightly different way, but this is a little more amenable to coupling with molecular dynamics simulations, where we have this mesoscopic effective Hamiltonian, which is also called a free energy difference. That in this case, this is an integral over the surface of our membrane. We have a bending modulus, radius of curvature, and I'm not going to worry about the other, I forget the name of the other component of the bending, but we're not going to worry about that one. We have this term here, which is very important, and can also be cast in terms of surface tension if you so wish. But what this is the thickness of the membrane, the bulk modulus of the membrane, which actually gives the modulus in terms of uniform contraction and expansion. And this is the plane strain, which the first order is delta A over A, where A is the area of the membrane. So you have two terms, a bending contribution and a bulk contribution. And in this sense, this guides us into how we are going to coarse grain our entire MD system. It tells us the material properties we're going to need to know in order to close the problem. So it's no accident that we chose a very simple one, because the more material properties you have to calculate, the tougher the problem gets. The dynamics of the membrane are absolutely critical and can be described by this Langevin equation for the height undulations. And this was kind of alluded to in the previous talk, that the hydrodynamic effect from the solvent is absolutely critical. That as the membrane undulates, it has to push solvent around. And without that, you'd have an elastic sheet that would just bounce forever. And in this case, where we're actually going to couple local mesoscopic plane stress signals, if we don't have this dynamics correctly, we're going to get an elastic signal pumped down to the atomistic level through just dilations and contractions. And, well, we'll get to that in a bit. Now, that's a very difficult problem to solve. And I think Frank might give us some insight on how to solve that in a more formal way. Our option is to what we use called, we call them free energy particles. And the idea is to discretize that previous problem with these, we call them macroscopic delta functions, which are basically just square hat functions. You can use more exotic forms. You can use a Gaussian if you wanted, or what's also one called the Lucy function from smooth particle hydrodynamics if you wanted to. And the idea is that if you insert this expression for the density field along with the smooth density approximation, you can get an approximate discretized solution of that Hamiltonian. So this is our original field theory for the membrane, quite a tricky thing to solve. You have to worry about boundary conditions and how are you going to handle the Ossian tensor and stuff like that. But if you transform it into a pseudoparticle representation, you get this new effective Hamiltonian out that now has the property of orientation, which corresponds to the normal membrane vector. And what's kind of cool about it, and if you're familiar with molecular dynamics, the ultimate dream is to cast your problem into a pairwise additive problem, because then you can just crank the wheel and you're off to the races. And so in a sense, that's exactly what we end up with. We end up with a pairwise additive interaction, not between atoms, but between strange particles that reproduce the original field theory that we wanted. And this way, we don't have to worry about boundary conditions. And I should also say that this chunk, this region that we're actually interested in, is also recast in this pseudoparticle representation. I think that a picture's worth a thousand words in this, that what we've actually done is started with particles, i.e. atoms. In this case, we take our pure membrane and bilayer, figure out the material properties that we need in order to solve the constitutive behavior that you're interested in, construct a field theory representation, and then discretize it into a new set of pseudoparticles. We take our protein of interest, in this case the M2 channel, and I should say that this entire system is like a composite system with its own set of material properties that are determined at that link scale. We can separately calculate the material properties of this region. They may be stiffer, it may be thicker, et cetera, et cetera. And the end result is we can create a patch on this mesoscopic membrane that has a matched set of material properties. So start with particles, end with particles. And I suppose And I'm only going to briefly talk about the solvent, the white solvent that we're using is called blobs, and I'm not going to go into too much detail except that it is also a pseudoparticle representation, where the dynamics of these particles are governed by this sort of Langevin equation. And it turns out that we can actually measure with molecular dynamics simulation the magnitude of the random force that occurs for a small fluid droplet, say about 1 nanometer across, or any size we want, really. And the important point is that the magnitude of this random force and the resulting drag force is orders of magnitude larger than any conservative force needed to, say, reproduce the shear viscosity or inverse isothermal compressibility. The interesting part is, if we take nothing more than this mesoscopic solvent, which is characterized by, say, the shear viscosity of water, let it come into contact with that membrane, we can recover the hydrodynamic scaling of the undulations, as predicted by the bending modulus, shear viscosity, and wave vector cubed. So it's we can actually capture the mesoscopic hydrodynamic effect with a mesoscopic explicit solvent. But I'm not going to...
confused. The random force of the Langevin part of this business, is that coming in pairwise, or just adding that on any part of the...
We have a pairwise scheme that conserves momentum to do it. I don't want to go into any more detail with that. But the point is that if you were to, say, look at Leonard Jones particles, they move around fairly coherently and have strong caging effects. If you look at these particles, they just sit there and shake. That is the behavior of them. And why use particles? Again, this is just to give you an idea that the particulate approach removes the problem of handling complex boundary conditions so that we can do things like look at vesicles if we want. Again, these aren't atoms. This is simply giving you a solution to some sort of continuum field theory.
So you're solving a continuum field theory with particles?
Yes, maybe.
So where did the molecular dynamics go?
The molecular dynamics has given us the material properties required for us to be able to say that this is a DMPC.
Oh, I see. So you do little simulations to get...
That's because that was just done in Tuesday and I haven't got all the bugs out yet. But it's just for artistic. But this is a little more formal at this point. We can actually do domain dynamics using a similar method to smooth particle hydrodynamics, which is called SPAM, which is smooth particle applied mechanics. I don't know why they decided to make different names. But in this case, if we were to actually dent the vesicle, we can actually see domains move around and couple to deformation changes. But this is an idea of, in a particulate representation, the problem of the boundary conditions just kind of goes out the door.
So theoretically, there's no boundary as to how many entities you could have on the surface.
Exactly. So, returning back to the problem, step three.
In this particle model for the membrane, have you imposed a constraint on the normal vector? No, wrote down in terms of the normal vectors of these particles. Have you ensured that the normal remains normal?
The normal, this component of the Hamiltonian, you can see, gives you an energy penalty if you drift off. If you take two particles, there's an energy penalty for dipping in. And you can show that to second order in delta theta squared, this gives you exactly this result. So beyond delta theta squared, this is an interaction that will, the lowest energy configurations for two particles in a plane. And you can actually take forces and torques off this thing and use molecular dynamics.
In other implementations of some similar things, what people found was that the how you choose these pseudoparticles with respect to the original problem made a difference.
Yes.
Do you find that here? And how do you do that? And how do you make sure it's robust?
Excellent question. The nice thing about this is there's a lot of analytic solutions in terms of membrane undulation dynamics and in terms of undulation spectra for the bending modulus, in which we can measure, we can actually take a pure membrane and check whether or not it's actually giving the correct undulation dynamics in the presence of the mesoscopic solvent. And also that this thing here is actually giving you, you see, in a sense, this thing here is an entire membrane determined by, say, a bending modulus. So if I take a membrane composed of these particles under zero surface tension, it should reproduce that bending modulus through thermal fluctuation.
Sure, but what about other effects that you couldn't verify at a continuum level?
Then I think we'd have to just wait till they rear their ugly heads and deal with them as they. I guess that is one of the problems is.
Yeah.
You can only know what you can measure at this point. So, step three, on this patch, due to the combined hydrodynamic effect and bending modes and local strain fields, this small patch with new material properties, and I should say that that chunk of the protein lipid is about 7 times as stiff as a pure patch of bilayer. It is a very rigid little chunk embedded in the membrane. And it will actually experience complex plane stress fields. Now, the model that we have does not allow for shear. We just ignored it at this point. So it is an approximate solution, which is amenable to the boundary conditions we're using at the EMD simulation. But what we can do is take the plane stress signal, which is this black line, and force, and I want to be very careful here, an individual atomistic level simulation to, in a sense, just go along for the ride. And that's what this dotted line is. And to give you a flavor, if you were to do just an NPT simulation, you'd have a perfectly flat line that the atomistic level system is forced to handle. So what you've really done is brought down an amplified set of equilibrium stress fluctuations down to an atomistic level system. Oh, I had 2 lines on there. The black line would be the input, which would be a flat line. The dotted line would be the response that would instantaneously one jiggle about that. The black line would be just that your flat input pressure, say zero. The atomistic level could jiggle around that. But the fluctuations would be, say, plus or minus one. This is where it gets kind of interesting, and this is where some of the subtleties of this come up, because what you can do is now observe the strain response of the two systems. And if I take this series here and blow it up a bit, this smooth line is the strain response of the continuum level model as governed by an elastic constitutive relation. You can see it's very smooth and very, very regular, and it's directly related to the plane strain response. The atomistic level response kind of follows it, but you can see that sometimes it does exactly the opposite thing that you'd expect. And that is you put pressure on a system and it expands the other way for a little while. And so this is where the subtlety of coupling an atomistic level system with a field theory comes in. So the previous discussion was in pictures. It gives you kind of a feel for it. This is I'm going to try and get through. I can see that I may have to give an abridged version. But this is multi-scale coupling not in pictures. We have an original atomistic level Hamiltonian under periodic boundaries. The constitutive model for our chunk is, in this case, just described in terms of plane strain. That is our choice. More complex variations could be chosen. But this way we only have to worry about calculating a couple material properties. The key is that it's linked through a constitutive relation of plane stress. And this is the link between the atomistic level system and the continuum level one, where this average is a time ensemble average, which says that if you take many atomistic level systems and at time t average their plane stress response, then eventually you're going to recover the constitutive relation that you're interacting with. The way we do it at the EMD levels with non-equilibrium EMD, and these may look like kind of strange equations of motion, but they really aren't that strange. A particles, and in fact, if anyone here does EMD, these are nothing more than the NPT equations of motion that you use. I haven't pulled anything out of a hat. But a particle's velocity has a number of components to it. Particle's velocity will have a peculiar component, which is related to the kinetic energy, and it's just the jiggling of the particle in the absence of any flow field. We have a strain rate in the XY direction, which is the part that we are pumping down from the mesoscopic level. We have a component in the Z direction. Likewise, the accelerations will be related to forces. They will have components here in terms of strain rate dilations in the XY plane.
Do sometimes people call this constrained molecular dynamics?
This one's not constrained. This one's actually known as slog molecular dynamics. I'll be very careful. This term here, depending on how you solve it, could be considered as a constrained MD.
But the idea is you're trying to look at the dynamics of molecular dynamics in this new...
Well, but the interesting thing is these equations of motion are very general and simply just give you a small n particle system subject to an arbitrary strain rate.
Okay.
That's all it does. How you choose to solve these things can give you either internally determined strain rates, and that would be NPT simulation, or external ones, and then you'd be non-equilibrium.
Then there should be some compatibility. The ones that you generate internally need to match.
Bingo. Absolutely. So that would... So the other player in here is this thing on the end, which gives you isothermal conditions. We have equations of motion for the area and the box length that also follow the strain rates. This red box is very important because this is the equation of motion for the strain rate, and this is how we couple the two systems. It's given by a Nose-Hoover integral feedback mechanism, where this P of tau is actually a time-average mesoscopic stress. And this is very important. We're assuming here that we can define some sort of spatial local thermodynamic equilibrium state, which is in fact the MD cell. But we also have to assume there's some temporal separation of time scales, and that the strain fields coming from the mesoscopic level can be treated at some level as quasi-static, because we need that in order to define a thermodynamic state for the system. And it's kind of like here that this is the equation of motion for your thermostat. You need to have a thermodynamic temperature here. This thing can't have time dependence in it, or it doesn't mean anything. You can't link it to a statistical mechanical ensemble. So if you want to relate the mesoscopic to the atomistic, the first thing to do is, it turns out that it's much better to look at the time derivatives of the two different Hamiltonians and see how do they compare. How do both of these systems change when subjected to the same strain rate? The chunk Hamiltonian is very simple. You have the thickness, delta P, and the time derivative of the area. We can use the previous equations of motion and calculate the atomistic, the instantaneous atomistic response to the same strain rate. This is what you get, and it looks similar. In fact, this first term here kind of matches this, except the time dependence in the z direction, it can change, where here it's a constant. And this is your instantaneous pressure, where this is the ensemble average part. It also has a term in the z direction, and it also has this thing, which is the rate of heat added to the system from your surroundings. And it's very important at the atomistic level picture. So the two aren't linked through their Hamiltonians. They are, in fact, linked through this. And this is known as the dissipation function, and it was derived by Evans and Searles in the context of what's known as the fluctuation theorem. It's a very interesting thing. And in fact, if you're doing MD simulations, this is just possibly the handiest thing to calculate, because what it gives you is the instantaneous entropy production rate. And if this is the dissipation function, it's defined through a time integral. If you grind through everything, it turns out that this is your distribution function at time 0 and t. This is phase space compression that is directly related to your thermostat and the fact that you've taken an otherwise constant energy system and let it come into contact with some sort of fictitious bath. This thing will be identically zero if your system is at equilibrium. So it's an incredibly handy diagnostic. You can measure it in a simulation. If it isn't at zero, something's going on. You've got heat coming in, going out, you've got a bug in your code. It is a very handy thing to use. And just to give you a flavor for how it actually works, if you have a constant volume system that's subjected to an external strain rate, starting from an equilibrium state, the time ensemble average of the dissipation function, again, that means you take a number of atomistic level systems and you evaluate the dissipation at time t, and in this case we're going to take it from equilibrium, so it's at t0. If you work it out, you find that it maps exactly over to the time derivative of the Helmholtz function. So this is how you can start to connect the two together. And a very important result comes out of this. This is the time derivative of our mesoscopic continuum level model. This is the dissipation function for our system subjected to the same strain rate. It has a number of terms, and now we're starting to take averages over multiple systems, which is very important. These two terms actually play off each other. And what it's saying is that any heat that your system produces is transferred to the surroundings reversibly by design. So those two cancel out. And what you're left with is the connection between an atomistic level system and its continuum level surroundings. And the important point of this is that you can't couple an individual atomistic level system to a continuum level model. You might have guessed that, but we've kind of beat this through the grind of the hardest way we can do. You can only do it through an ensemble. And this shouldn't really be that surprising, because when people look at Helfrich-like models, they often say, well, this is the free energy of your membrane. Well, this is where the free energy part of it comes. It is actually giving the ensemble average atomistic level response of that system. So this is kind of the important picture that comes out of it. I'm actually going to skip a little bit after this, because I want to get to some results. The important point of concept of attempting to couple atoms to a continuum level model is that if you're going to construct some sort of mesoscopic Hamiltonian, the two are linked only when you use an ensemble of atomistic level systems.
So does this give you a sort of on-the-fly way of checking whether you're consistent?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow, that's really nice.
Yeah, that's exact. And given the time, there's a whole bunch of stuff here about local thermodynamic equilibrium, the Gibbs dissipation function. I'm going to do this. The dissipation function was originally constructed in terms of the fluctuation theorem, which is a cool thing, because the fluctuation theorem roughly answers this question. What is the probability of observing for a system of n particles studied for a time t that your system will go backwards under the influence of an external field? And by backwards, I mean that it actually violates the second law of thermodynamics. And this has been proven with simulation and with experiment. And in the context of this system where we have an atomistic level system that's being hit by a strain rate, for example, you can imagine the scenario where if you apply a positive pressure on your atomistic level system for a time t, and over that time it expands, a single atomistic level system expands, then you've actually observed a so-called second law violation. And that is the nature of atomistic level systems, especially when you consider proteins. A lot of times they go backwards. This is the expression for the steady state fluctuation theorem. I'm going to bring it up here in a little, just kind of give you a flavor for what it does. It has a left-hand side and a right-hand side. And the left-hand side is a probability ratio that you can, say, measure in an experiment or a simulation of observing the backwards versus forwards atomistic trajectory. So this is the number of times it goes backwards and the number of times it goes forwards. You can relate it to, at least asymptotically, to the dissipation function that you measure. And if the two agree, it gives you some information on just how out of equilibrium and how long does the system actually go backwards. And this is why you can't use just a single atomistic level system that is coupled to a continuum level model that's essentially governed by a constitutive relation. Because if you were to calculate the steady state fluctuation theorem for a single atomistic level system, this is, in a sense, giving us the probability of observing the system going backwards, i.e., if you compress it, it expands the other way. And you can see that for even up to 80 or 100 picoseconds, there's still a finite probability that the system will do exactly the opposite thing that you would expect. Now, if you take an ensemble of systems, these fluctuations will eventually average out, and you will recover the continuum level response. In a sense, that's why most people, if you want to attempt to do a single atomistic level system, you need a buffer region to handle these so-called violation events. So,
I've been wondering about what sets the time scale here, picoseconds. I mean,
does that seem really small?
No, it doesn't. It seems reasonable, but I'm just wondering, where it really comes from. In other words, if you saw something where something went backwards for 10 times that time, what would give you a sense that that's not the right thing?
I think it's a very valid question, because, and I think that it comes out that in an MD simulation, for example, the fundamental time step of the simulation is 0.002 picoseconds. So that's the time increment that things go on. So if you observe a second law violation that goes for like 0.01 picoseconds, I kind of go, whatever. I'm not that excited. If I observe a second law violation that goes for 100 picoseconds, then I start to think, well, this system is actually evolving in time backwards for a small amount of time.
But there's some uncertainty relation or something that gives you a sense that time is reasonable. It's not related to your time step. It's related to
the physics of this problem. Well, for example, experimentally when they did it, maybe this is another example, they had a DNA that was trapped, they used a laser trap. And they simply pushed it around with the laser trap. And they saw that thing go backwards on the order of a second. So there's a meaningful time scale that, and again, it's I guess depending where you decide to make it interesting or not, I don't know if that answers your question.
Actually,
oh.
Yeah, in just trying to connect this to some extent to biology again, biology is very discrete, and you may even say it's atomistic. There's a single channel open, a single receptor binding, mm-hmm. or a single enzyme operating. So in our thinking of fluctuations, do any of those atomistic systems go backwards?
Yes.
So now you're talking, when you get into single molecules or that kind of scale, that you can get not just what the biologist or biochemist tells us is the reaction.
By definition, you the biology has incorporated the fact that it has to go backwards X percent of the time.
So there's deterministic and non-deterministic.
Well, it's an interesting question. The way I think of these are deterministic fluctuations and not random noise. That they are intrinsic to the system. It's decided through its own interactions that it's just going to go the other way for a while. Two steps forward, one step back.
Yeah.
But shouldn't the system, it's ergodic, so presumably ensemble averaging should be equivalent to running the system for long enough.
But these are now time ensemble averages. I want to take a number of atomistic level systems and examine all of them at time t under the same field.
Oh, I see.
So it's kind of mixing the grid up a little bit.
Yeah.
So quick summary, and I'm going to do this last bit in 5 minutes, which is kind of from the very first slide of the talk. Yes, we can couple atomistic level systems to continuums. You don't have to take out the periodic boundaries. You need to, if you want to formally link the two, use an ensemble of atomistic level systems, because this is an approximation to begin with. And when this is done, the response of your chunk, the red patch, becomes the same as the ensemble of MD systems, which is exactly what we saw in the very first slide, that the two responses actually start to come into sync when you average over enough configurations. So this is the so what slide. Three things can happen when a membrane-bound protein is coupled to a membrane, a mesoscopic stress field. And it's like we've done all this work to show that you can do it, these are the properties of it, et cetera, et cetera. Well, now it comes time to do it and see, does this make any difference? And I can see that three things could possibly happen when you take an atomistic level system and you kind of trick it into thinking that it's part of something else. And the first thing is absolutely nothing. We're at equilibrium. These are zero surface tension fluctuations. In terms of any measurable structural, dynamical, thermodynamic property, nothing has happened. And what that would say is that MD simulation under small periodic boundaries is pretty good. Option two, that over time, the protein actually falls apart when we let it couple to these mesoscopic stress cells. And that would be very bad, because the whole idea here is to sense let a membrane interact with more realistic surroundings, not non-realistic ones. And that would say that we've got a bug somewhere, something seriously wrong. Option three, something slightly changes a little bit. And that's the best you can hope for. So this is the picture that we're doing. We've got an ensemble of atomistic level influenza A M2 proton channels embedded in here. It is now going to respond to stress fields. And what we're going to do is even make the question more specific. We're going to look at only these four histidine 37 residues, which comprise the narrowest part of the channel and are, in fact, the thing, kind of the sand in the hourglass kink for proton transfer. And see, does the structure or anything of this change in a before and after scenario? So, how much time? I got another 5 minutes? Okay, cool. First off, root mean square displacements. Now, this is kind of the legend here. A is the open channel. There's an open and a closed state. The open state is protonated. So it's much more open and sloppy. It's got its electrostatic repulsions. The closed channel, this is actually a snapshot of the closed channel. It's a very rigid structure. It's kind of got four histidine residues poking in tightly. We can do it with and without multi-scale coupling. If you don't want to do multi-scale coupling, you just comment it out in the Fortran code and don't worry about it. Then it becomes just an ensemble of atomistic level systems under NPT. So in this case, the first thing you can see that the root mean squared displacement from the starting state doesn't change that much. It's a little bit bigger under multi-scale coupling. The reason is that the root mean squared displacement is almost entirely determined by thermal atomistic level fluctuations. And the intrinsic magnitude of these thermal fluctuations are about 100 times greater than the very slowly varying mesoscopic strain rates. So in terms of our RMSDs, I would say they're fairly similar, not much to lose sleep over. But there is something interesting. This is the effective volume of this residue chunk that you can calculate through the radius of gyration. It's not the volume, it's just a relative measure of the volume. And the first thing you see is that over time, under multi-scale coupling, this sloppy open channel actually expands a little bit to occupy a slightly less dense state. And within the statistical noise, it's actually a little bit bigger. And we even observe this in the closed state. These very soft strain fields have allowed the system to expand just slightly.
If you do bigger scale simulations of full molecular dynamics, does that trend?
That is on the to-do list.
Okay.
You need a really big input. Check box number one, which kind of involves the answer, are these mesoscopic strain rates that we're actually hitting our system with correct? And, in the dying moments, I'll make a comment about that. The effective area, this very rigid structure that is the closed state, seems to go to a state that has a slightly larger area, and its thickness goes down a little bit. Conversely, the sloppy open state doesn't really know. So it looks like the rigid structure is actually directly coupling to kind of the symmetry of the XY strain field by going to a slightly elongated state. And this is the final picture of what you see. This is the open state of the histidine 37 residue, and I pulled three snapshots out of the ensemble of eight, under multi-scale coupling and without. And the motif that seems to be appearing is that this doubly protonated residue, which is responsible for kind of opening the channel up, seems to poke into the channel quite robustly and in fact pushes this guy out into the wall a bit. And it says that is the origin of this slightly increased volume, that the residues actually have tipped up a little bit and pushed themselves out. And again, this is the barrier to proton transfer. So the bigger the hole, you might actually see larger conductance. Under NPT, you don't see this motif happen. And in fact, the density of these residues is slightly larger. So, which one is right? Good question. Well, the one thing we do know that when we do is called empirical valence bond simulation for proton transfer, and when we just do it with standard MD, the conductance is about 3 or 4 times too small compared to experiment. Would the conductance of the channel increase if it was subjected to multi-scale coupling and hence opened up a little bit? Well, I wish I could tell you, and I'll put that under the... That's next on the to-do list, and the really big MD simulation is the final thing to do. And I'm just, those are the acknowledged summary. I've said it a couple times, and I'm just going to leave it off with the acknowledgments. Greg Voth, Liam McWhirter, Raghu Chang, Yuji and Hanning for teaching me all the biology I need to know, which I have to coach me on weekly because I seem to forget it, and Sterling for being great with the fluctuation theorem part and all that, and the NIH for dollars and cents. Thanks.